So today is what, May 18th, 2011. I'm Rick Hansen, and I'd like to explore with you tonight healthy desire, healthy passion. And maybe I'll even stand up so you can see me. What a concept. So, in a Buddhist setting, which is what this is, there's always a question, what really is healthy desire? Is healthy desire an oxymoron in Buddhism, a contradiction in terms? And, Buddhism reminds me of my dad, great guy, still going strong, sharp as a tack at 92. He read some stuff I've been writing, so I didn't realize he was on my email list. It's kind of horrifying. You realize your brother was reading your stuff, oh my God. He said, Rick, I think this Buddhism is really good for some people. And I went, oh, really, Dad, huh? And my dad's grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, cowboy, rancher, Midwest, right in that culture, very practical, very decent, very fair person, analytic, science person, became a zoologist, kind of very conscientious to a fault. He's the kind of guy, if you get the little manual for your cell phone, he like reads it and underlines it, stars, puts questions by things. If there's a contradiction between a couple of words, he calls the call center in Mumbai, drives them crazy. He wants to know. He's really a get to the bottom of it kind of guy. So, okay, great. I thought, well, so was the Buddhist, so maybe there was a fit there. But so I said, well, what do you mean, Dad? For some people. He said, well, for people who are suffering. Like, not me. Like he doesn't. I went, oh, okay, I get it now. So, sure. So Buddhism has gotten the rap. It's the suffering religion, right? It's about suffering, and you have to suffer more to suffer less later, and if you ever suffer less at all. And it's about the de desires, right? The desires that make us suffer. I mean, that's the common rap, right? And Buddhism is this sort of dour, it's the bummer religion, as I once said at Spirit Rock, and if it's a religion at all. And I want to explore that with you, particularly in the context of the notion of social justice. And so to get into that, what the Buddha taught essentially, relentlessly, and really see for yourself if he's your cup of tea or those teachings are your cup of tea or their aims are your cup of tea. But at least in terms of what he taught, he was relentlessly committed to the end of suffering and to what he called the highest happiness that is peace. So that's the goal. And like a good scientist, 2,500 years later, last name Hansen, my dad, the question then becomes, what's the cause of suffering? Right? How do we attain this end of suffering and this highest happiness, which is peace? How do we do it? So we need to know the causes. We need to understand what causes suffering and therefore the end of suffering, which is what the Buddha said was the one thing he taught. In a way, it reminds me a little bit of a mathematician I worked for a year doing risk analyses, probabilistic risk analyses of things like the odds of a nuclear power plant melting down, right? Quick sidebar, one of the things that struck me about that was that these engineers did these super meticulous models of a very complex system, a nuclear power plant. And then they would think probabilistically about the failure rate or the success rate of different elements within this complex system that could prevent a meltdown. And it was all very scientific and very rational and very well done, very sincere, very conscientious. Lots of hard work went into it. And I was a totally naive guy with a penchant for math, and that's about it. And the fellow I worked for, I was his number cruncher. He was the mathematician overlooking the whole thing. Well, large way through it, I noticed that there was no accounting for human error. We had all these boiler pumps, we had all these things. Was there anything for human error? And so I ended up asking some of the engineers there, gee, do you guys account for human error? And they said, well, no, you can't account for it. It's just happens. You can't factor it into the models. I went, well, what was the source of Chernobyl and Three Mile Island? Oh, human error. So, there's a limit to rational analysis. Okay. That said, the analysis in Buddhism is that the fundamental cause of suffering is what's known as thirst or craving. The word in the original language the Buddha taught in, Pali, is tanha. That's the source of suffering. It's not desire per se. It's not desire that makes us suffer. It's this craving. Or in a nutshell, it's the distinction between healthy desires and unhealthy desires and being healthy about desire. In other words, wisdom is about what we desire and how we go about desiring. So, for example, in Buddhism, there are all kinds of illustrations of healthy desire, of things you're supposed to desire. You're supposed to want, you're supposed to wish for, you're supposed to intend, you're supposed to aim at, you're supposed to make effort for, you're supposed to strive for. There are countless examples, actually. It's kind of striking. I was just, you know, roughing out a bit of a list, and I was startled that it kept growing and growing and growing. Right intention in the Noble Eightfold Path, eight elements. The second one traditionally listed right after right view or right knowledge, right understanding, is right intention. And the intentions there are threefold. We intend to not cling to things. In other words, we intend to have a kind of renunciate stance to things, even as we enjoy them. Second, we intend to not harm ourselves and others. And third, we intend to not have ill will. Or more exactly, we intend to have goodwill. We intend to have good wishes. We intend to have good desires. That's right intention. Or right effort. The language of right effort is that one should awaken, language is this, one should awaken desire for the abandoning of the unwholesome and the creation, preservation, and rising of the wholesome. One should awaken desire for. Right? Wow. Positive desire. Or what about desire for all kinds of wholesome factors that lead to good results? For example, the seven factors of awakening. Desires for mindfulness, for investigation. Desires for energy. I'll come back to that later. It's a form of passion. Desires for tranquility. Desires for bliss. Wow. Desiring bliss? Desiring joy? Desiring happiness? Or how about the factors of concentration? Two out of five of those factors are intensely positive, emotionally, right? Bliss and happiness. These are very positive desires. How about the desire for awakening? The Buddha praised that desire highly, the wish to awaken. Other desires are to wish beings well, that you be okay, for example, you know? And those beings include us too. For example, compassion is the wish that beings not suffer. Kindness is the wish that they be happy. These are very positive. These are invited. These are celebrated in Buddhism. How about other desires, like to be ardent, which means heartfelt? It's one of the four common words you've heard me quote probably that are used as descriptors for people who are serious about practice, that they're ardent, resolute, diligent, and mindful. Right? Energy. I mentioned energy before. There's also the language of striving. One should develop and cultivate striving in positive directions. These are all good desires. And then last, just for the moment, generosity. You know, whether it's the generosity for this school for girls or the generosity of someone who's helping someone else right now. Many, many forms of generosity. So these are positive desires. Okay? Okay so far? So, more broadly, if you think about it, and, you know, as you know, I think about this stuff fairly often in more of a biological frame or an evolutionary frame or more of a neuropsychological frame. To live is to seek goals. Whether it's an amoeba, you know, seeking to absorb some molecules that it needs, or whether it's an earthworm seeking to turn left rather than right at a junction to avoid an electrical shock. It's been trained as down the right-hand thing. Whether it's someone desiring to cough, to get something out of their throat. You know, we pursue goals. We cannot do anything, but all living beings pursue goals. Those are desires. Those are wants. You can't not want. The question is, what do we want, and how do we go about wanting? We are creatures who want. It's nature to want, to to have goals, to have aims, to have purposes, to have inclinations. Hand on the hot plate, the goal is to get the hand off. You know, woman in labor, the goal is to get that baby home to safety and out. You know, the goal of being at the end of a long day of work is to get home with your family and friends. You know, it's natural to have goals. Also, if you think about it, emotion. What's the nature of emotion? Most emotions have desire embedded in them. Fear. The desire is to get away from some kind of threat embedded in fear. Anger. It's to energize around some issue or problem, maybe an injustice. Shame. It's the desire to reestablish a sense of worth and equilibrium. Loneliness. Right? The desire to belong, to reconnect, to find love. It's interesting, the word emotion is emotion. There's emotion. It's expressed, it's moved, it's motivated. Again, emotion is natural. The development of emotion in our ancestors 200 or so million years ago, the first mammals and birds, the first mammals then, birds later, was a fantastic development. You know, and embedded in those emotions that served our mammalian ancestors really well are all kinds of desires. It's really wild, isn't it, to put it in this larger perspective. You realize, wow, there's a lot about desire that's actually healthy, that's necessary, that's appropriate. Desire per se, desire is not the enemy. Desire is not the problem. It's not a problem that you have desire per se. Also, if you think about it, some desires are appropriate for one time but not later. In other words, you know, think about the desire of a child to intensely hold on to an attachment figure. You know, a preschooler or toddler that's all equanimous and dispassionate about being, you know, left in the grocery store while the parents walk out the front door. That's not a kid who's going to pass on his or her genes, right? That would not be appropriate. Later on, obviously, someone can still love their partner, love their loved ones, and yet be less disturbed than a two-year-old in a grocery store, you know, when they're separated from the ones they love. Or desires, for example, that are very focused on education and training in one's teens and 20s. And then those desires kind of move more to the background as we get older. Or desires to flourish and really rise and succeed in a career. Those desires tend to move more to the background, naturally, as people move into their 70s, 80s, and 90s and beyond. Right? So they're natural rhythms of things. It's the Buddha's metaphor, you know, of the raft, right? You come to a problem, or let's say a river of suffering, you build a vehicle, a raft, let's say, to get you across. But once you're on the other side, you don't keep carrying it around, right? You set it down. It's a transitional method. It's a means to an end. Some desires are like that. They're appropriate at a time. They may be inappropriate later, but at least for now, it's an appropriate desire. So that's where the Buddha's notion of chanda comes in. Chanda is the Pali word for healthy desire. Distinct from unhealthy desire, tanha, which is craving or thirst. I'm going to do it like this. So what are some examples of healthy desire? Well, for one, as I've talked about before, as we evolve, first rule, you know, the first we developed three motivational systems, basically. The first system was to avoid harm. You know, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right? That's kind of like rule one in the wild, all right? That's level one. That's more of that reptilian insect brainstem layer of the brain. Then comes the second major stage, approach rewards. Stage one, avoid carrots. Avoid sticks. Stage two, approach carrots, all right? Get the rewards, ramp up, be able to pursue them in nuanced ways. Then we have stage three, which is to attach. To attach to us, to attach to friends, to family, to tribe, to the village it takes to raise a child. Okay. in those three systems, which we cannot pull out of the human nervous system. They're there. It'd be like pulling out our lungs or our heart or our digestive tract. It's not natural to do that, right? In each of those three systems, there is a deeply embedded desire that's very healthy to seek a positive state of equilibrium, a positive resting state, which basically is characterized in terms of the avoiding system as a state of peace. Not at war, not in fear, not threatened, not harmed, not having anyone one cares about potentially harmed, etc. A state of peace. In the approaching system, there's a deeply embedded desire to seek a state of goal fulfillment, of general fulfillment. Call it gladness. You know, call it happiness altogether. That's natural in us to desire that. That's chanda. That's a healthy desire. And in the attaching system, there's a natural embedded desire to be loved and loving. Those are innate, natural, wholesome, biologically endowed desires. They are actually literally as innate to us as the desire to blink when a hand comes close to the eye. They're that natural. As the desire to take a breath if you haven't gotten enough air. Another example of chanda is positive activation of the sympathetic nervous system. And by the way, as I go through these desires, it's worth asking yourself how well you are fulfilling these healthy desires. Whether it's a healthy desire for peace and safety and strength in the avoiding system, or a healthy desire for basic success, basic goal attainment, basic satisfaction in terms of the approaching system, or basic aspects of belonging, feeling cherished and valued, feeling loved and feeling loving in terms of the attaching system. Additionally, another area to look is in terms of healthy activation of the sympathetic nervous system, which is the stress response wing of the nervous system, but it's also what gets going if we're excited about something we feel great about. You know, maybe somebody you really care about has had a wonderful thing happen for them recently. You know, for example, if our son, you know, who is this kind of intellectual, not terribly coordinated, I'm being recorded, but that's okay. Guy, you know, goes into the Boy Scouts and he builds this little, as they do, this little race car they do in Boy Scouts, and then they race it on these inclines, and you have these boys compete with each other and whose car wins. And you think, this is silly competition. Trust me, there's massive amount of ego and blood in it. And our little, beautiful, blonde, slightly pudgy then kid, his car was winning. We were astonished. When did Forrest ever make anything that ever worked, you know? And we were so excited. Like, that's healthy activation, all right? You know, someone you really were glad to win won something on American Idol or on the recent presidential election or whatever it is. You know, you're happy about that. Or maybe to do anything that matters. You get revved up about it. Our kids right now are really getting into West Coast swing dancing. That's a thing that has a lot of healthy passion in it. Making love, frankly, means a fair amount of sympathetic nervous system activation, particularly as you approach the climactic moment. You know, projects, art, you know, like getting stoked about making something beautiful or preparing a meal, just getting excited about having friends over for dinner. There's a place for healthy passion. And personally, for every one person who's way too manic and needs to take a chill pill, I think there are probably 10 people who, frankly, are kind of sleepwalking through life and really could use a little more juice. Because lots of times when we grow up, we learn to dial it down. We're too much for other people. You know, the Japanese proverb, the nail that stands out gets hammered down. And it's worth asking ourselves, especially if, like me, I don't know if anyone else in the room is in this boat, is in middle age, you know, there's a tendency to just kind of let the fires flame out. And, gee, I'm with Dylan Thomas. I don't want to go quite quietly into that long, dark night. You know, especially while my heart's still beating. Ain't dead yet. So you might want to think about that as well for you. There's something important and healthy about excitement, about healthy passion, about enthusiasm. That's a wonderful wonderful word, enthusiasm. The root of it means endeos, God within. Right? Enthusiasm. Right? Another healthy passion or healthy desire are developmental accomplishments. Finishing school if you're young, getting established in a career, raising a family if that's of interest to you, finding a partner if that's of interest to you, learning skills. It's natural for people to want to do that. There's a term in developmental psychology, mastery motivation. This is people who want to master something. Those too are very, very healthy desires. Self-actualization, another healthy desire embedded in our own psychology, to fulfill ourselves, to flourish, to use our abilities. I often think that one of the greatest pains, the greatest forms of suffering or sources of suffering is thwarted love. You know, people who want to give love and yet are blocked around giving love. They want to contribute. That's really tough for teenagers. It's hard for them to contribute. In relationships, very often the wound is that one person wants to give the other person love and the receiver won't really take it or creates obstructions around it. Or somehow, for whatever reason, is the pathway is blocked. Right? We want to fulfill our abilities. I think about thoroughbreds versus plow horses. Right? Plow horses, what they want to do is just kind of mosey up and down the furrow. Right? That's what they want to do. Thoroughbreds, Mustangs, boom, they want to run. That's their nature. It's fulfilling their abilities, fulfilling a talent. If you have a talent, if a person has a talent that's a significant talent, then you know it. And most people really do have a significant talent. Almost everyone has a spike. So I think everyone does. Maybe there's an exception somewhere. But if you're not really fulfilling that talent and making room for that talent, even as an avocation, as a hobby perhaps, amateur means someone who loves what they do, right? You can be an amateur and your passion is perfectly fine. But if that passion is not expressed in some way, again, there's something that's blocked, right? That creates suffering. That's not natural. It's like not breathing. And then one more here I'll say is a desire and wish for the welfare of beings, a basic stance of benevolence, right? Again, very healthy desire. We wish for their welfare. In the bodhisattva ideal in Buddhism, we wish for their complete awakening. You know, one of the aspects of the bodhisattva vow that's taken in Zen, and other people can do it as well, one aspect is, beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. You know, in other words, it's infinite, and I vow to take care of infinity, essentially. That's the commitment in the bodhisattva path, to the awakening of other people. As well as, you know, commitment to the welfare of others in terms of what the Buddha called, in more ordinary language, the happiness that is visible in this present life. That's okay too. It's not just about wishing for the welfare of others in terms of their white light experiences, but wishing for their welfare that honestly they can make their mortgage payment. You know, I read a chart recently that showed that on the average, basically from, you know, people who collect Social Security by age, but it's pretty much about the same all the way across, that on the average, Social Security in America accounts for about 65 to 75% of the income, sometimes even 80% of the income of older people. And the poverty rate, another way of looking at that, the poverty rate among seniors who do not get Social Security benefits is 45%, are below the government poverty line, which is really, really, really dirt freaking poor. There are people who are living above the poverty line that are standing on corners with street signs saying, we'll work for food, or can you, you know, spare a dime, because they're living still below the poverty line. I mean, above the poverty line. They can't get benefits. And yet the poverty rate of seniors who do get some Social Security, at least some, is only 9%. Right? So, you know, we would wish for the happiness visible in the present life that someone doesn't need to stand on a street corner begging for money, or that someone has access to health care, or that, you know, frankly, someone finds a good mate, you know, maybe has come out of a bad relationship, and you just would wish for the happiness visible in this present life, that they find a good partner of their own choosing. You know, there are many forms of happiness in this present life. And what this means, if we wish for the welfare of others, we also must wish for the conditions, pardon me, that promote that welfare. This is a very important and interesting point. Any view in Buddhism, as well as science, is very grounded in this view. Any view that looks at causes and conditions has got to see causes and conditions in a nested way. They stack, right? They rest upon each other. And if you care about the welfare of someone, in general terms, including things like access to medical care, or having enough food, or being treated with ordinary respect in daily life, and not forced to sit in the back of the bus, for example, or having equal opportunities to rise in the corporate, in the corporate ladder, or have a chance to go to a school where you can actually learn something. Those foundations are linked to the capacity to do spiritual practice as well. If we care about people's awakening, we need to care about them, frankly, being able to have food. You know, famously in the Buddha's own story, his awakening was in some senses dependent upon having enough food. Which, of course, ultimately and very directly takes us to social justice. Takes us to caring about the world we live in. Directly, both benevolently, out of caring for the welfare of others, including the highest level of awakening possible, there's a direct chain, there's a direct series of stepping stones. It's like a stair. You know, the 10th step requires the first and second step beneath it to get to the 10th step. And if we care about awakening that's at the 10th step, full enlightenment, we have to also care about the causes and conditions that enable people to practice to the point of enlightenment. You know, to use Abraham Maslow's metaphor in terms of levels of need and so forth, someone who's starving looks at an apple tree, doesn't see a thing of beauty or an object of paint, unless they're an incredibly unusual person, but sees a source of food. Or someone who is fed but needs shelter sees that apple tree and sees a source of lumber and timber, you know, to put a roof over their head to keep the storms away. It's hard to do practice when your life's in complete upheaval. Or, for example, you can't set aside time for yourself because you are so committed to taking care of the needs of your family or your aging parents and so forth. So out of benevolence, we have to, you know, that takes us right to social justice. Out of self-interest, it takes us to social justice. Because we're interdependent, you know. If we care about our own welfare, we care about the welfare of the world. I just got back from New Zealand. Do you know how many homeless people I saw in the streets of Auckland? I was there for a week, downtown, all over the place. Zip, not a one, okay? Walk around downtown San Francisco for the same amount of time, count the number of homeless people you see asking for a handout. It's a lot more than zip. It changes everything when people are in an environment there. My brother lives in Australia. He has a medical problem. He doesn't worry about that because he knows he walks into the clinic, pays $5, okay, gets his prescription, and he walks out, he's done. Our daughter is living in France right now, although she'll be home in a few days, a semester abroad. Medical care there is amazing. You just walk in, it's handled, you walk out. You know, it's not perfect. There's no system that's perfect. But when you live in a society like that, crime rates go down, you know, social services can be allocated for other purposes. We're affected by that sort of thing. Other forms of social justice, pollution. As many have pointed out, you know, the coal that's, for example, spewing in Appalachia or China doesn't just sit right there, right? It crosses all kinds of borders. The John Donne line, right? Don't send to ask for whom the bell tolls, you know, the bell of someone, the church bell that rings for mourning. It tolls for you. We're all in the same boat together. So that's another reason to care about social justice. It's also the case that we're naturally moved to help others. You know, it's interesting, the research that's being done on compassion and the evolution of compassion, which in a funny way doesn't make sense from a narrow, hardcore biological evolutionary standpoint. And yet it does make sense for very social beings like primates and hominids and then humans and us today to really be moved by the suffering of others and want to do something about it. You know, studies on Tibetan monks who are awakening and train in intense compassion interestingly showed that parts of the brain that just naturally activated, even when they were just said, just be compassionate, including non-referential compassion for all beings, nobody in particular, guess what? The premotor circuits in their brains started to really activate as a kind of priming of the inclination to help. You know, compassion naturally leads to the desire to help. So to fulfill that natural desire also takes us to trying, that's a healthy desire, that's chanda. That's another form of chanda, the desire to help those who have touched our hearts, those who suffer. So fulfilling that is also, you know, a form of social justice. Another example is the gladdening of the heart you're given. You know, it makes us happy. You know, if you're interested in less suffering and more happiness, kind of pragmatically, giving is good. It's personally really, really tickled my heart to do this thing with you tonight about the Darya Academy. It's just been funny. And I was talking to someone about something else. Lately, it's just been really striking to me how happy it makes one to give. You know, generosity just makes you happy. Can you think of some example of when you've maybe given or been generous that for you is just, wow, that was so meaningful, so fulfilling, so satisfying, whatever it was. You know, working in a homeless shelter on Thanksgiving Day one time, or reading to a little kid, or, you know, dropping 20 bucks in the homeless guy's cup on Christmas Day just to blow his mind or something like that. Any examples? Okay, good. Maybe just think for yourself. You know, it gladdens the heart. That's another good reason to do it. So, of course, as with any desire, a healthy one or not so healthy, we've got to be careful about how we do it. So I'm going to say a few words about that, and then I'll invite Joanna to talk with us a bit about the Darya Academy, the school for girls. I hope you saw some of the pictures of some of the girls in there. Really just kind of knockouts. So first off, it's important to recognize that it is a desire, and that the desire, the want, okay, and the objects of desire, and the fruits of desire, are fundamentally what's called empty. They're transient. They come. They go. They don't have any inherent existence, which really takes us to the stance of wisdom about not grasping after them. In other words, in the mind especially, and it's also true out here in material reality, there are no things. There are only events. There's only flow. There's only this moment. There's only process. And things are made of, events even are made of many parts. They arise depending on other conditions and then they pass away. They're empty. You can't grasp them. They're insubstantial. The fundamental error of the mind, and this is the deep analysis of the Buddha, is to reify processes into things. It's a smart move to keep animals alive, all right? But it sets us all up for suffering. Because everything always is a process, and it's empty of any absolute existence, so we can't hold on to it. Everything is a standing wave. Even El Capitan is a standing wave. And certainly any mental event is simply a standing wave. The coalitions of neurons that form, that underpin a thought, an emotion, a desire, or the pleasure of attaining the desire for fill in the blank, a cookie, or your son's little race car winning, or something like that, you know, that little coalition, that eddy in the stream of consciousness, if you will, that little moment of self-organizing pattern lasts of 2 to 3 seconds. That's it. Disperses out and the new eddies form. So knowing that as we approach the desire itself, the object of desire, and the fruits, the satisfaction of desire, takes us deeply into wisdom. Another thing about desire is not to identify with it. It arises in the mind as one more mental content. The problem is that we make it special. Right? We give it power over us. Desires have an insistent quality, so we give way to the insistence. Or even worse, we identify with the desire. we make it ourselves as if, again, that's an entity rather than an event. We make the desire our own. My precious, you know, that thing you want, it's mine. The desire arises, thunk, I identify with the desire like that. Obsess over it, elaborate around it. And again, we identify with the obsessing, we identify with the elaborating rather than letting it be. There is obsession. There is desire rather than I'm obsessing or I want. Third suggestion about how to practice with desire, take in the results. When the itch is scratched, stop scratching. You know, when you get the message, hang up the phone. Take it in. Fill the heart. I think so much of what makes us continually hungry is we actually don't register the rewards. That goes to the whole thing about taking in the good. You know, the brain's biased toward the negative, and unless we really register the positive, it flows through the brain like water through a sieve. So important to register the fruits of desire, particularly wholesome desire. You know, if it's an unwholesome desire, register it fast and move on. I had a guru who once said, once a philosopher, twice a pervert. So if you're going to do it, taste it, know it. One time is enough, you know. Okay. Let the benefits, fourth point, let the benefits flow through you, you know, of the fruits of your desires, you know, your healthy desires. As you accomplish things, as you fill your heart with love, as you learn where the really cool bagels are, whatever, you know, let the benefits of that flow through you to benefit others. I think it's also important, fifth, to stay grounded in the body. Because in a sense, very often we get into trouble about wanting when we go up into our head about it. We kind of lose touch with the body. And very often the body is telling us, really, I've had enough. I don't need to keep eating. You know, there's a Sufi saying, at the end of every meal, the body, the stomach should be one-third food, one-third water, and one-third air. It's a good saying. So we know when we've had enough, you know. Or we can feel inside ourselves, no, this isn't quite right. This is not that good for me. My head is saying, yeah, baby, you know, but my gut is saying, not so good, you know. Okay. Also, keep opening to wisdom, you know. Are you losing your balance? Like sometimes we get really too into our even healthy desires. Is this a tunnel with no cheese? Maybe there was a healthy desire to go down this tunnel looking for cheese, and the cheese was healthy. But really, there's no cheese down that tunnel. That dog won't hunt. You know, you'll never get milk from that particular stone breast, right? It's just not going to happen. It's time to fold them rather than hold them. You know? Or should you hang in there? You know, that's wisdom too. Also, are we getting caught by an initially wholesome desire? You know, the brain likes its molecules. It likes its tastes. It likes dopamine. It likes its reward transmitters that say, this was good. And what started out so often as a healthy desire can go too far. That, too, is what wisdom's about. Okay. Then to close here, I think that in terms of really appreciating the benefits of healthy desire, it's great to motivate oneself toward chanda rather than tanha, toward healthy desire rather than unhealthy desire, by marinating, frankly, in the rewards of really healthy desires and taking them in. It's great to gladden the heart. The Buddha recommended gladdening the heart in the recognition of one's own good deeds. So tonight, as an example of that, we have an opportunity to really gladden our own heart in the recognition of the good deeds of contributing to this school for these really precious girls living in really tough conditions, you know, in Africa, Kenya and Africa. So I thought I'd ask Joanna to come on up and maybe say a word about Daria and answer any questions we might have.
Great, thank you. Well, just really quickly, talking about passion, this is my absolute passion. This is a high school in Northern Virginia started 3 years ago, by actually a couple of years ago, well, lived here in Glendale. And they set out with the idea that they wanted to start a school. They went, they actually found a property, which is another full story. But they went and asked the neighbors and the people in the and the tribes around there what they wanted out of the school, with the possibility of educating the girls. And now we know that as a way of looking at any society, the way to do it is to educate the girls. But they're the ones that bring back the most back into their neighborhood. So there are roughly 40 tribes in Japan. As of last year, there were 18 tribes represented. So it's also all about, you know, let's get together and you know, be able to get along with each other. These girls live in abject poverty. Secondary education is considered free in Kenya, but the fact is you have to pay for the uniforms, you have to pay for transportation, you have to pay for books, you have to pay for pencils and papers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's basically not free. And if a family is already very, very poor, if they can manage it, they don't can afford, they don't seem sure. So a lot of these girls end up in sex trade, they get married off to older children. The stories of some of these girls is just absolutely heartbreaking. It's unbelievable where they come from. And their desire to get an education and to give back to their communities is just remarkable. And talk about getting this gratitude from things that we do. We actually, we ran. I walked the day break this Sunday for the first time, way out of my comfort zone. We were 55,000 people, but it was a fundraiser for Garage. There were 77 girls here. 77 of us walked and ran. And we managed to raise enough, we managed to raise $53,000. So that's actually enough to send 26 girls a full year of school at Garage, which is actually a boarding school, so they get all their meals, they get all their clothing, they get a great education. So I, you know, developed this huge amount of huge satisfaction going through this race and then knowing that I've been able to raise the money. So what we're talking about, what I'm asking for tonight is Equatorial Africa has a large garage of sorts, and they're trying to have a huge garden there. And most years they have a drought. And what we're trying to do, we're trying to raise $5,000 to put in a drip system, which uses a fraction of the water that just hoses, which is what they're using now. We've managed to raise $500 so far. And for $5,000, we can get the whole system, we can get it installed, and we can get somebody who's going to care for it and help them with that. So Rick was so incredibly generous to say, you know, we were on the phone, and I could just talk about stuff. So I just, maybe I'll just add this, I don't know.
What were those girls doing while you 77 Americans were in the Beta Breakers?
Yeah, so we're over here in the Beta Breakers. The 77 girls were running laps at the same time on the campus. It's a big, you know, they had like 60 acres, and so we were running laps around them. And so each of us had a photograph of one of the girls. It brings tears to my eyes. And they were running, and they all ran 7.5 miles. It's pretty amazing, yeah. These girls are incredibly dedicated, and they had originally started out that they were going to be 25 girls each year. This is now their third year. And all 3 years, there's been one more girl that just somehow or other managed to get in. That's why they have 26 per class. And for example, the first year, there was a girl that came and sat at the gate for every day for 2 weeks. was raised in the same time. So what is it to do? Well, it's been 26 years. Yeah. So we're actually, my husband and I are going to take 13 high school students with us. We're leaving in about 3 weeks. We go back. We were there last year. And we're taking all these students over and we're going to sort of learning to be kids. And we've got all these projects. I don't know. Are there any questions? The sheets out there have a website called Garage Academy. And Deborah Santana made this incredible 10-minute DVD about the girls there and the middle school. And it's on the website. You go and look at it. It's really a beautiful, beautiful piece. They've really pulled this thing out of thin air. And they have an incredible amount of support. And you go there and my life has changed. Well, that's a great question because this, at this point, this is only the third year. So we don't have questions off on the meetings at this point. The goal is that, I mean, every girl will not go to university. There's no way to go about it. And so one of the things that's really being developed are entrepreneurial skills. We're talking about having a developing a micro-lending institution at the school, which in fact the faculty have, which I should also mention, all the faculty are training, all the employees are training. It's all about empowering the girls and empowering the women. So it's not the Americans going over and saying, you can do this, and this. It's all about, you know, we're going to provide the framework. So anyway, so what we're looking at is the faculty already have this little micro-lending thing set up for themselves. They put in a part of their salary, and then that way that serves as collateral, and each, you know, certain period of time, one of the teachers can take borrow from that as collateral. And so we're trying to come up with something like that for the girls. Certainly some of them will go to university. But, you know, I never heard from these kids, oh, I want to go to the U.S., you know, I want to go to the University of the U.S. and that and that. And all of them, they, to a girl, talk about getting back to their community. So, it's getting them their secondary education to start with, and then where they go from there, you know, we're working this out at this point, you know, as long as that can be moved. So. Yes. Well, they're actually, my husband teaches at Marine Academy, and so they're all Marine Academy students. And, it should be made out through Clark Educational Foundation.
2 hours.
2 hours, thank you. And I can either take it with me now, you can go to the Garage website and donate directly to Garage that way with a credit card. So either one is fine. I'm happy to take it tonight. More than happy. So, anybody else? Yeah. Garage means bridge in Swahili. And their whole thing is about, they say, Garage means bridge and we are the bridge. And so what they're talking about is making this bridge to the bigger community, to the wider community, a bridge to education. And I'll tell you, we have met more dedicated group of girls. They're up at 6 o'clock every morning. Breakfast is late, classes all day. They study at night. It's really, really nice.
Maybe one more. Tarni, did you have a?
Has the community been supportive of the school as a family of resistance, excluding the young lady?
They love the school. They absolutely. goes over there, they're encouraged to go. For example, there is a Maasai village, maybe a couple of miles from the school, that some Maasai women have set up as a way of supporting themselves. And so volunteers are encouraged to go to that village and pay to go in. And so they're actually, this school has supported a lot of people all around them by doing this sort of thing. Everybody, most everybody goes on safari, for example, and there are a couple of Odyssey safaris that is really doing very well because of that. So, no, they're very, very, very much supported. Yeah, very, very good.
So it's like an economic ripple from the school
exactly.
through the whole culture nearby.
Yeah, exactly.
Nearby. Yeah.
Much better way.
Okay. Yeah. Last one.
Last one. Then as they start to get older and start going to school, they'll learn vegetable Kiswahili, which refers to the language of Swahili. And then, but school is all taught in English. And so all these girls know three languages. Yeah. Did you have another question? Oh, okay.
I was curious how one of those four languages.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thanks to Joanne. Her husband, Mark's been a long-standing member. You would recognize him if you were here. He was, he's a legendary science teacher at Marin Academy where our son went, and he was very kind to our son. So when I got this email in passing and I saw also the involvement, I mean, Mark and Joanne have really walked their talk. They put real time in there, which I think for a lot of people is the real mark. You know, putting time in. And they put real time in there. So I want to acknowledge that. That's a lot of that's what inspired me, especially. How about we just sit for 1 minute, let it sink in, and then we'll wrap up. And if you care to express some healthy desire here through generosity, those baskets await. Night.